Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we begin our program today talking about the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia, the politics of the Supreme Court, and nominations, and where this takes us, how this feeds into the presidential election, and more. We join you in studio once again. It's been a long time since she's been here, but now that the children are grown a little bit and she's back in full swing and her writing allows her to leave the house, Marta Mossberg is back with us, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute. Good to have you back,
Great
Marta.
To be here, Mark.
Good to have you back. Stephen Klepper joins us once again, lead attorney at Crayman and Gramer's Appellate Practice. Good to see you, Stephen.
Thank you. Good to be here, Mark.
Joining us on the phone is Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Doug, thank you for joining us here. Appreciate you taking the time.
You're very welcome, Mark.
And Charles Ellison will be here shortly. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. Your thoughts on all this, 410-319-8888 is the number to call. Doug, let me just start with you, and then people can chime in as well on this. I think a lot of people are curious. So let's say, for argument's sake, before we get into the heart of what all this means, that President Barack Obama's nomination is blocked by the Republican-controlled Senate, and they don't allow the nomination to go through a confirmation process before Obama leaves office. And there are some significant cases, which we'll talk about a little bit, that are before the Supreme Court in this session. What happens with 8-8 with a 4-4 tie?
Well, a 4-4 tie means that the appellate court that decided the case, that ruling will hold, and whatever the lower court decided becomes the law in that jurisdiction. But it doesn't have the national implications that a Supreme Court ruling would have. And what's important here, Mark, to keep in mind is we have a Supreme Court that has been divided on many of the critical burning issues of the day. And so we have a liberal bloc and we have a conservative bloc, and it's usually a 4-4 down the middle, and then Justice Kennedy provides a swing vote. Here, when Justice Scalia, who usually represented one of the sure votes on the conservative perspective, now we have a situation where Justice Kennedy, if he were to join the conservative bloc, that would result in one of two things. Either the case would return, as I mentioned earlier, or the court could decide to re-argue the issue once the ninth justice was selected.
You were going to say what, Marta?
No, I didn't know how that worked when you were missing a Supreme Court justice, what would happen. But I guess, I mean, that's really interesting that it would become law of the land in the jurisdiction where it was first heard, but not nationally.
Right. I mean, the cases like coming up, like the Texas case around affirmative action, the Texas case around a choice and abortion rights that taking place, which is another huge one, and Friedrichs versus CTA, which was the California Teachers Association versus a number of teachers in California who did not want to not have to pay dues to the union. I mean, those are some major cases that are coming up.
Yes, correct, Mark. And there is not a written down formal rule for which cases might be, as they say, affirmed by equal division 4-4, or the cases that would be re-argued later. When Justice Kennedy joined the court in February of 1988, some cases were just left 4-4, and some of them were argued in late April in time for him to join. And it's believed that it would be you need 5 votes for there to be re-argument. And I could very well see, for instance, in the Texas abortion case, Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote, who frequently doesn't make up his mind until after argument, saying, I want to join and have this held over to the next term so that I can have a fuller view of the issue. And let's not forget, Justice Kennedy very much relishes his role as the swing vote. And so some of this really could play into which cases get re-argued.
So, but this also, I think, lends itself to the question that we can tackle for a moment about the politics of all of this. And the arguments going back and forth now, President Barack Obama saying he would not fill it in while Congress was out, that he was not going to do that, which he could have done legally if he wanted to, from what I've read.
Arguably.
Okay, we can talk about that. Though many people were pushing him to do that. He said he did not want to do that. But the argument that some Republicans are making that as if a president does not have the right to make a nomination at the end of his term or her term, we haven't any hers yet, end of his term, is there any accuracy to that? I mean,
no.
Historically, there's not.
No, of course he has the right to make a nomination, but the senators also have a right to reject that nomination. I think I believe Barack Obama voted against every single George Bush nominee, so on ideological grounds. So sure, he can nominate, but it doesn't mean that the Senate has to consent to that nomination.
Correct. And there are lawsuits by Republicans out there accusing Barack Obama of not complying with his constitutional obligation to ensure that the laws be faithfully executed. And the Constitution says that he shall make nominations. And that's shall means shall. And I agree with Marta, though, that it doesn't mean that the Senate has to confirm anyone, but it does mean they need to live with the consequences if they refuse right. to do that.
But there's a difference between, Doug, not confirming and opposing and not allowing hearings to go through to debate it.
Yeah, and I think what's important for the listeners, Mark, is to try to appreciate the different ways in which justices make their decisions. I mean, it's not as though we're not talking about a group that's bright and understands rulings very well, but Justice Scalia had a very clear judicial philosophy. We call it originalism because he almost always went back to see what the the founding fathers would have decided way back in 1791, and so the originalism is something that bumps up against the view that the Constitution is a living document, and it evolves over time. And so many people would say, look, if you're going to go be an originalist, then at least you have to include the Reconstruction, the Civil War amendments that eliminated slavery and established equal protection and other fundamental voting rights. But Justice Scalia usually began the clock back in 1791. And then the other part of his philosophy that also limits congressional power is that he is what's called a textualist, which means he is going to look at the way in which Congress or the legislature writes a law, and it's going to be the plain meaning of those words. He's not going to look for a context, or he's not going to look, you know, to see what was the purpose behind the Affordable Care Act, but rather he's going to really parse those words, and he's going to have a literal meaning to everything. And often what that will do is it will defeat the purposes of our elected legislators, but the originalist also means that people who were not regarded as citizens when the Constitution was formed, and that's many people did not have any rights, beginning, of course, with African Americans and people of color, and, of course, women, and, of course, many of the foreign-born groups. So when we look at Justice Scalia, what's important about who replaces him is whether he or she is going to have a similar philosophy or whether they're going to see the Constitution as this living, evolving document that really has extended rights, including the rights of legislators.
Well, I would say that, I mean, I agree with most of what you've said as far as how he interprets the Constitution. But what I don't think he limits Congress. What he's saying is that he's standing there preserving the freedoms and liberties guaranteed by the Constitution and saying to Congress, go change it if you don't like it, saying to the state legislators, go change this if you don't like it. But I can't interpret that from the Constitution. You know, when you look at the Obamacare ruling, for example, he was looking at it when Congress wrote state, the court interpreted it as federal as far as, requiring the exchanges to happen. And if they didn't, then it would null and void the law. So I think that the Congress knew exactly what they wrote and right to do that. And the court disagreed with Scalia on that pertinent. But his main goal was just upholding the freedoms and the limited government that the Constitution construed and saying, sure, you're free to go change it and to evolve, to progress in any way you want to, but you have to do it through the legislature.
And I would agree. picking up on Marta's point, Justice Scalia was very concerned with creeping technological advancement, and he was very concerned that new technology didn't override the rights that people had traditionally enjoyed since the before the Constitution. And so Justice Scalia was, in fact, very frequently joined the more liberal members of the court on matters of does the technology such as DNA testing infringe our traditional privacy under the Fourth Amendment.
And GPS tracking as well, things like that.
So. Exactly. He wrote a forceful dissent in a case that was out of Maryland. It was Maryland versus King that had come out of our Court of Appeals, where the question was, somebody who's merely arrested but not convicted of a crime, can the state take their DNA sample and then use that to track down other crimes they may have committed? And Justice Scalia wrote, we will catch more criminals that way at a cost. And that is not a cost that's compatible with the founders' view of the Fourth Amendment. And it was Justice Breyer, and may still wind up being Justice Breyer, a Democratic appointee who is the swing vote, who frequently joined the more conservative members on matters of the police searches.
No, and Mark, just to jump in on that, I mean, there is a part of Justice Scalia, particularly in the criminal rights area, where his libertarian
and flag burning, for example, too.
Yeah, well, he did show a very strong concern for individual rights in certain areas, and so we find, for instance, that that he stood up for the fact that the prosecution cannot use testimony without the witness having been cross-examined by the defense. So the confrontation clause became a very big issue for certain cases in the criminal arena. To enhance punishment, Scalia again stood up on the side of the individual defendant that said that there must be specific findings for there to be an enhancement of punishment. So it's not as though we can say Justice Thomas is a much more reliable voice for the causes that usually are identified with the conservatives or the right, the far right in our country. But Scalia, you know, he was a very strong voice, and make no mistake about it, that voice is one that's going to be difficult to replace if you are a proponent of most of his issues. But what I was saying before in terms of interpreting laws or interpreting congressional intent, usually we like to look at what did Congress have in mind? What was the purpose of this particular law? What was the objective in passing any particular law? Justice Scalia said we're not going to even look at that part of constitutional interpretation, but rather let's look at the plain language and see whether or not that fits the role of congressional legislators.
Yeah, Martha.
Right. No, I mean, I think that, and I would agree with how Justice Scalia took that, because you can't, how do you discern intent? I mean, there's so many different ways. You can't read people's minds. So what you have is the law itself and the language. I mean, he thought that words matter, and that's how he interpreted the law and read it. He thought it was clear and simple, and just based his opinions on what was written, not on what people could have been thinking when they were writing it or debating it.
So I wonder what you all think about the what you sort of allude to, Doug, a minute ago, which was the consequences of his passing. I mean, not in a human sense, but in the legal, in terms of the Supreme Court, because I mean, he was leader of the conservative wing on the court, wrote the most kind of profound opinions, changed the nature of a lot of things in this country, from Citizens United, issues around choice or women's right to choose and other issues like that, and some very fundamental laws, health care. So what do you think this sets up, Doug, and how does it set it up?
Well, I think it just raises the stakes considerably, not only for the national election of the next president, but really of the people who are going to become our senators and who are going to have a great deal of control in both the Senate and the House, because and certainly in the Senate, in terms of the selection of the next justice, it will be largely determined by the composition of the both the Judiciary Committee as well as the full Senate. So we're looking at an election where the stakes are substantial in terms of the future direction of our Supreme Court, and because it's such a closely divided court, I would expect that we will probably see a much higher turnout of voters because all the candidates are going to be looking at the importance of the next election, and whether you're on the right or the center or the left, you're going to be wanting people to come out and vote.
Yeah, this becomes, I mean, we've always talked about the nature of the Supreme Court really being very decisive in what America looks like. It's almost more than sometimes elected officials do because of what they can decide and what they have decided, and that the, what we call the liberal court in the Supreme Court, quote-unquote, from Roosevelt's time, the Warren Court, was really a, in some ways a blip in time when it comes to the history of the Supreme Court. It's usually been towards the conservative side, not towards the liberal side. So this is this, so that given the ideological warfare in America now over who we are as a people and where this country is going, this moment I think becomes a very profound moment, both in terms of the judiciary, our laws, at the direction of the country. I mean, there's a lot at stake here, no matter what, depending on how you look at our world. So I think that Charles, you just walked into the studio. Good to have you here.
How are you doing? Good to be here, man.
I'm glad you could join us a little bit here. So. You want to jump in on that? Then we'll go around the room.
Right. It is very very consequential what's happening right now. It's definitely something that seems scripted out of a movie, like straight out of a movie. You know, some folks were making that comment. And some colleagues I was talking to, you know, you can't script this. No, you know, I have seen a few, you know, science fiction dystopic movies where, you know, the Supreme Court justice kind of like, you know, dies at the most or suddenly has to be replaced at the most inopportune moments. And so, you know, it's definitely the last thing that you expect. It's the last thing we actually want during an election year, particularly where this election year, you know, it's really interesting. It's very fascinating to kind of watch out, like just what you just said, in terms of how the court makes these major decisions that have these long-term consequences and consequences as far as our cultural, as far as our social, political and economic makeup as a country. And so, you know, and then you're having this election at the exact same time that's dealing with those same issues as far as just, you know, the electorate's or at least one half of the electorate's discomfort with a lot of these dramatic demographic changes that are happening over the landscape. And so we did have some cases that are actually being deliberated right now as we speak in terms of affirmative action. We've got also two voting rights cases. These cases, I mean, those are these, you know, as far as affirmative action and voting rights, these have like, you know, enormous consequences as far as underserved people of color, particularly Black and Latino communities are concerned. And so, you know, and suddenly the Supreme Court justice passes away. And so that throws a whole new twist into what's happening. So it's very fascinating, I think, to kind of watch this alignment as, you know, the court was deliberating these really, really major cases that were basically determining the fate of civil rights as we know it. And then you have this election that's kind of determining the fate of kind of where things are headed demographically, socio-politically, socio-economically for the next 20 or 30 years.
Doug, you want to jump in? I think you have to leave in like 5 or 6 minutes, so let me let you jump in here.
Yeah, well, I this is not the first time, you know, that we've had situations where someone has either died in office or and we've had re-argument on some of the most important decisions the courts ever ruled. So in Brown v. Board of Education, for instance, Earl Warren took over. He hadn't heard arguments in Brown v. Board of Education in 1952, and so they rescheduled the case. In 1953, it was re-argued, it was decided in 54. In Roe v. Wade, that also was re-argued when we had a change of justice officials, and Citizens United was a third case that comes to mind. So that would seem to be you know, the prudent course, that if you're going to make a national ruling, you don't want to make it with seven justices or eight. You really do want a full court there. And I would expect that that's going to happen because we have, Mark, as you mentioned, we have cases pending in just about every critical issue that we look at. And whether it, you know, whether it be voting or whether it be unions or whether it be reproductive rights or racial bias and jury selection, affirmative action, I mean, immigration, I mean, there's just every major issue is before the court.
Marta?
Well, I think we're at a very pivotal point as far as the difference between, you know, a group of justices who care about the rule of law versus those who see it as a living, see the Constitution as a living document. And Scalia, I think, was its most ardent advocate as far as we have a constitution of laws that we are going to follow that need to be changed through the legislative process versus reinterpreting a constitution based on today's mores. And so whoever comes in to replace him and other justices who may, who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is sick, we don't know how long she'll be alive, this could be, I just think, incredibly consequential for generations to come.
I agree. Go ahead, Doug.
I just want to say one thing, and that's in response to Martha, because
Marta.
It sounds very... I'm sorry, who?
Martha.
Martha, my apology.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. But, you know, it sounds so good the way that Martha says it and many other conservatives say the same thing. We want the rule of law. We don't want judges making up the law. But, you know, if we took Justice Scalia's philosophy, most of the major decisions that we live with today would not have been decided. He was against Brown v. Board of Education. He was against the ruling in Gideon versus Wainwright, which guaranteed a lawyer for poor people. He was opposed to so many of the cutting-edge decisions which have given women their rights, as well as African Americans, Latinos. And so it's a very dangerous philosophy to say, well, he's the only one in favor of the rule of law. He's going back to the way he thought the framers would have decided things back at the time of the Constitution in 1791.
Well, he's asking the legislature to make the changes. He's saying, this is what this document says. This is what we were given. This is what our republic is based on. We're not going to make up a new meaning that didn't exist at the time that it was written. And if people want to rewrite the Constitution, then that's what they need to do. But for as long as it stands, as long as our government is based on what is written in that document, then that's what he's interpreting.
I just have to jump in. We have to take a quick break for station ID. Come right back. Doug, you have to roll this.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure, and I thank the guests as well.
I appreciate you taking the time.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Professor of Law at the University of Maryland's Carey School of Law. Doug had a faculty meeting to go to, so he had to dash. I'm glad he could join us the first half an hour. We'll come right back to our other two guests here who wanted to jump in on those last comments. 410-319-8888. Jesse in West Baltimore, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call as well. Stay with us as we look at the political and judicial consequences of the death of Justice Scalia. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with Marta Mossberg, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute, Charles Ellison, political strategist, host of the Ellison Report on WEAA every Sunday night at 9, and Stephen Klepper, who is a lead attorney with Crayman and Graham's appellate practice. Get that first name right. As I've said over the years, I should know it by now. And you all are 410-319-8888, and write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. I want to go to Jesse and Mike, but both of you wanted to jump in, so please do. Charles and then Stephen, then we'll jump in.
It's really funny. I mean, it's you know, we always talk about the courts being non-political or being non-ideological, but you know, you had jurists like Scalia and like others, and this is both on the left and the right. You know, it's this myth of this non-ideological, very balanced, unbiased court or court system. I mean, it's not just the Supreme Court; it's everywhere else. And that's just not the truth. I mean, Scalia was one of those jurists who proved that the court can be very ideological. And then there are folks on the left who are the exact same way, whether it's a Ginsburg or anyone else. But you know, it's kind of funny how you do have folks on both the left and the right. But in this case, with Scalia, you have conservatives arguing that, oh, we don't want any any judicial activist to replace Scalia, but Scalia was a judicial activist. I mean, he basically used his ideology and figured out ways to match it with what was in the law, and then to promote his own sort, his own perspectives and his own points of view. And a lot of that is going on. And I think it's not just in the case of Scalia, but you know, I think it's also kind of funny that now there's sort of this double standard in saying that, oh, President Obama can't perform his constitutional obligation and pick someone to replace Scalia because, oh, we're afraid of someone being too ideologically bent. Well, but, you know, Reagan did the same thing in picking folks like Scalia in the first place, right? So there's a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of double standards that are kind of being thrown around by a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle, but in this particular case, particularly being thrown out now by conservatives in the case of Scalia, you know, it's heard this double standard and this hypocrisy about, oh, you know, we don't want judicial activists. Well, that's what you guys have been doing. That's why you're trying to stack the court with folks who think like you.
So on the way to the phones here, I just want to say that when you look at Reagan's final appointment, which was just like this one at the very end of his term in 1988,
right,
was Justice Kennedy, who he appointed November of 88. Just as he was leaving office, as a lame duck. So,
nominated in November of 1987, yeah. Confirmed in February of 1988.
Yes, you're right. You're right. So, but one of the things I was going to say, Steve, and then we'll go over the phones here, is that when I think of the Supreme Court, the history of the Supreme Court, look, and we talk about the ideological battles, that for most of its time in American history, the Supreme Court was the bastion of white men who were conservative, moderately conservative, and didn't disagree that much. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Republicans and Democrats in the 40s and 50s, especially the 50s, got along so well. They weren't that different on many on the spectrum, unless you were from the South. I mean, they were kind of this moderate kind of conservative view of the world. And I think that's part of the battle. This is a new Supreme Court. It's a new era. We're in an ideological warfare now.
We are.
In a deeper way than we have been, I think, in decades, if not over a century.
Well, Scalia is himself the embodiment of the reaction to the war in court. It has not been a problem, certainly not since Roe versus Wade in 1973, to keep Republican evangelicals in line on the Supreme Court as being a major issue. That is the reason you won't cross party lines. Scalia genuinely believed everything he said.
No question.
He was, in that sense, intellectually honest. He was not a result searching for a rationale, and very frequently it brought him to unexpected places. For instance, he and Clarence Thomas were in the dissent arguing that the Constitution imposes no limits on punitive damages in civil cases. Very surprising places. However, I do think that towards the end of his career and of his life, he did see President Obama as a major threat to the rule of law. And if you read his Arizona immigration case dissent, everything about it, to me, as I read, said, can't you all see this? President Obama is destroying the rule of law. It was written in his most bombastic terms with none of his characteristic humor. It was just almost apocalyptic in its language. And when I read that, I said, wow, they haven't decided same-sex marriage yet. I bet he lost that one. But what I would say when it comes to the rule of law, and I very much agree, the rule of law that he was seeking to defend was the same one that had kept the white propertied men in power throughout
the
constitutional history, which was the main objection. What Scalia said, and he honestly believed, they asked him, if you could change something about the Constitution, what would you do? And he said, we should make it easier to amend the Constitution. But until we do that, until we pass an amendment that changes how we pass amendments, I have no mandate other than what the Constitution has meant and always meant. And where I really think the rubber hit the road here was during the same-sex marriage arguments, and I think these were the ones in 2013 leading up to Windsor, he asked counsel, when did same-sex marriage become a right? What changed? can you identify for me the date when the Constitution said this? And for him, that was the point. Now, many of my friends, and I see the legitimate arguments on both sides, say, well, that's the wrong question to ask. But that is the only question Scalia asked, and he thought that was the right question to ask.
So let me open the phone to you. A lot of people are calling in. Let's let them jump into this before we turn into politics completely. 410, which we are going to do, 410-319-8888. Jesse, you've been holding on a while. Welcome. Good to have you on the air.
Yes, thank you, Mark.
Good morning.
Several things about Justice Scalia, and I just want to follow up the point regarding judicial activism. Republicans often say, you know, we need someone who's not going to legislate from the bench. But in 2008, the D.C. versus Heller decision, I think, is a prime example of Justice Scalia regarding the Second Amendment and concluding that it applies to individuals being able to own and possess and carry a firearm, when the Second Amendment seems to strictly talk about state militia. So I think that's one example of his judicial activism and the irony and the hypocrisy of the Republicans to say that, you know, we don't need someone who's going to legislate from the bench. I think, secondly, you know, the irony of Justice Scalia was an originalist, looking at the text. And now the Republicans are saying, well, we need to wait until a new president gets in office. President Obama should not nominate someone. Well, I think Justice Scalia would say the Constitution states shall. There's not an option. The president shall nominate. We elected Obama for 4 years, not three. And finally, you know, Justice Scalia was known for his biting dissent. And I don't know, in this era of polarization, if he started it or he contributed to the divisiveness, but, you know, he was known for some very ferocious attacks against his colleagues' ideas and thoughts. And I think he would say, I attack ideas and not people, but how do you separate the two? So those are some things that just strike me about Justice Scalia that I just wanted to add.
Jesse, I'm glad you held on. Really very kind of profound, thoughtful statements. I appreciate it. Marta Mossberg, let me go to you before we turn to the other side of the table. Not necessarily ideologically, just other side of the table.
Well, I think that Scalia was was a very clear thinker, and he spoke his mind. And we were talking about that earlier. And it didn't prevent him from having great friendships on the bench with people he strongly disagreed with. I mean, he was great friends with Justice Ginsburg. I think he went hunting with Justice Sotomayor.
Justice Kagan.
Oh, Justice Kagan. Things like that are, I just find really interesting, because I think it allowed his clarity of thought allowed him to have real arguments and real compromises with people where he could, because otherwise there's no compromise when there's no principle involved. So I don't take issue with him speaking his mind. I wish more people did that. I think people are flocking to Bernie Sanders and to Donald Trump because they speak their mind. I don't think that's divisive. I think it's just people saying, I'm done whispering. I'm done having to just follow the status quo. So
And what I should say is that didn't go for all the justices. Sandra Day O'Connor apparently was quite offended by some of the rhetoric that Scalia used in some abortion cases, because Scalia felt legitimately betrayed by any Republican appointed by Reagan who would not vote against Roe versus Wade. And he had very little respect for the undue burden test that she enunciated. And I was with a small group that met with him one time, and as per usual, if people asked him what his least favorite decision was, it wasn't Roe versus Wade. It was Sandra Day O'Connor's undue burden decision. He never let that go. And Sandra Day O'Connor was proud of that. And I do think that it is certainly polarizing, some of the rhetoric that he used. Now, Scalia would have said yes, but you know, the audience I'm writing for understands. But Scalia was writing for a country, and actually, I realize he did say he wanted to write for the common man. That was part of the pitch he made for himself in becoming a judge and then later justice. I think these are legitimate points. But you also need to understand that Scalia wasn't quite the activist that we always perceive him. He did quite a bit to feed into that perception. But for instance, in the D.C. versus Heller case, Scalia rejected the NRA's argument of what the Second Amendment meant as to its scope. He did go further than four justices would have in finding that it granted an individual right. And the militia phrase in the Second Amendment. It says, in the interest of a well-regulated militia, the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. The NRA wanted a ruling that that meant that the Second Amendment gave the individual the right to bear the types of arms that would allow them to rise up in revolution if a government turned into a dictatorship. And Scalia rejected that. He looked to the history, seeing that there were gun regulations since the beginning of the Republic, and he said, you need to have just enough to hunt and to protect your household, because that's what guns had been for. And so very few gun regulations are actually unconstitutional under Heller. Really, the problem for people who want gun regulation is our political system, where the Congress will not pass those if that is your goal. The Supreme Court has not been the paramount obstacle for people who want gun regulation.
So therein lies the dilemma. I mean, in terms of what sort of Supreme Court you want. I think Marta makes some real, you know, good points, solid points about, you know, you definitely want advocates on the bench. You want advocates who are going to, as you say too, about, you know, speaking for the common man and woman, right? But then I think that this period that we're in now, with Scalia passing away and now looking for a replacement, it forces us to ask as a nation, a really deep question about, well, what type of Supreme Court do you want? I mean, that becomes problematic in terms of speaking your mind, because do you want a justice who speaks his or her mind, or do you want a justice who follows, you know, that rule of law, or follows or does what they're,
well, I think he did
that,
both.
Do you want that person who's
publicly a lot outside of his decision?
Yeah, but when you're speaking your mind, it kind of goes off the rail a bit in terms of looking just interpreting the law, which is what the job of a Supreme Court justice is, not to force their opinion so much, but they have to sort of force their interpretation of the law. At least that's the perception among a lot of folks. I mean, there's this illusion out there, there's this myth that Supreme Court justices are supposed to be these unbiased advocates, and they're not supposed to be forcing their own personal opinions or personal, maybe you can sort of, you know, use your personal experiences as a way to help guide you through that interpretation of the law. But Scalia just seemed to be, was being perceived as someone who would just force his own personal viewpoint and personal perspective. And that just rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because they're like, well, you know, you're supposed to be here interpreting the law, but you're not. And I'm not political strategist, I'm not by any stretch like a legal theorist, but it's just that was the thing that bothered folks about people like Scalia. That's what bothers some people about Clarence Thomas. That's what bothers some people about a few other folks that are on the Supreme Court. But there's this just illusion that the court is unbiased and not political. And when you have folks like Scalia, he proved that it is. And I think that that's problematic. We need to start asking that question. What type of court do we want?
I do want to get the phones here. Okay, and come right back to everybody here. 410-319-8888. Mike in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm very well. Welcome.
Hey, there's a lot of tongues wagging about the Republicans not confirming or saying they won't confirm an Obama nominee. I was looking in the Wall Street Journal today, and I saw a quote brought up from July of 2007 from Chuck Schumer, who was on Judiciary at the time, and it says, "We should not confirm any Bush nominees to the Supreme Court except in extraordinary circumstances." Apparently, 18 months before Bush's, before the election, the Democrats were drawing a line in the sand saying, don't confirm any Bush appointees. So how is that any different than, say, 9 months before an election that the Republicans are, it seems like an awful lot of the Democrats' chickens are coming home to roost here.
Well, let me throw an idea on that we can debate this. I think that the big difference here is, there's a difference between the tone of saying we're not going to allow President Obama to nominate, we're not going to pay any attention to what he's saying, mm-hmm. and people. I think the difference is that what the present leadership is saying, we're not going to even have a hearing. We're not even going to allow this to be a public debate. We're just going to shut him down and not allow this to even come out. I mean, I think that's the fundamental difference. And Chuck Schumer is not one of my favorite human beings politically on the planet. So, I mean, I'm not going to defend anything about Chuck Schumer does. But I think that to me is the difference. Maybe my panelists disagree. I'll let them go at it. Steve, Marta, go ahead.
I think that if the roles were reversed and it were a Republican president, a Democratic-controlled Senate, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg or another Democrat were to pass during on the exact same timing, that the rules would be perfectly reversed and Democrats would be making these same arguments precisely as they did in 2007. Politics in many ways is hypocrisy. It is opportunism. And that's how – but what it doesn't do is make it right. And that – however, because this is politics, what it means is that what is President Obama's goal in naming a replacement nominee? He's going to do that. Now, Republicans have drawn a line in the sand, and they did it within an hour of the news that Justice Scalia had passed away. I mean, that was rather startling. Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell's tweet that he did of the statement, it was, "We mourn Scalia's passing, and by the way, this vacancy should wait," which...
But to me, that part, Marta, is the most outrageous. It's not that you're going to oppose what President Obama does. It's the fact you're saying... it should wait, that Obama has no right to do this. I mean, that's the part that bothers me the most.
Who cares what he says, though? I mean, he does have a right to do it. We know that. So let him.
He's the Senate majority.
Right, I know. But let him nominate someone and see what happens and face the consequences. On either side, we'll have to face the consequences for their actions. So
right.
I don't think that it's I don't think it's a big deal that he said that's what politicians do. We're not going to, you know, they say we're going to block the nominee, but it doesn't mean that Obama doesn't have the right, doesn't take away the right just by saying that we don't want whoever he will nominate.
But I think what he was doing was some Republicans are saying he has no right to make this thing. I think that's a problem. And I think what Chuck Schumer's is a problem as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's both.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton for the first time mentioned the Constitution mm-hmm. when she said that, you know, we're hurting the Constitution by not allowing a Supreme Court justice. I don't think she's mentioned the Constitution mm-hmm. once in her entire campaign so far. So it's very convenient at different times for different people to bring up what's right and wrong.
Yeah, I mean, politically, you have both sides. I mean, they're sort of positioning themselves and they're positioning their bases to make really strong arguments that can serve as voter mobilization tools for this election. I mean, there's an opportunity. I mean, this is what they're talking about sort of behind closed doors, whether it's McConnell, whether it's Schumer, whether it's Reid. It's like, you know, how can we use this moment to mobilize our respective bases to make sure people turn out in November, whomever the nominee is, because this could be one of those base driving decisions. The calendar, the timing is everything. You know, but still, it's a bit. Is there any precedence for that? I mean, where you have the Senate Majority Leader or you have the person who's in charge of the majority basically setting that kind of tone, just saying right after a Supreme Court justice passes. Supreme Court justice isn't even cold yet. I mean, Scalia's body's not even cold yet. And it's like moments later he's saying, oh, we're not going to allow. I mean, you know, fam, give it till Monday, you know, to have that conversation. Let's wait till after the Sunday talk shows. Like, you know, give the man's family. I mean, he's got 9 kids. And it's like, give a man's family some time to just mourn and give the nation some time to process it. I'm just trying to figure, and yeah. I may be wrong. I've never seen that before, at least in recent memory, where a Supreme Court justice passes, there needs to be a replacement. And within seconds, the Senate Majority Leader, the guy in charge of setting the calendar for the Senate in terms of confirmations and votes, is saying, oh, you can't do that. It's just something that's really offensive about that. I think a lot of voters, particularly a lot of independents, let's not even talk about Democrats and Republicans. Independents are going to be the decisive vote in this particular election. I think that came off really rather presumptuous of McConnell on a number of levels, and it was just a little bit offensive.
I don't know that anyone. I don't know that many people really. I mean, Jay Leno, I think, has done this many times mm-hmm. in the past. Ask people who the Supreme Court justices are, name mm-hmm. them, and in his jaywalking segments, no one knows who they are.
That's a good point. Yeah.
There are certain people who care very much about that issue,
yeah.
And it will be a rallying cry for some. But I don't know that it's going to be as big an issue that some are making it right now.
It could, however, play like the government shutdown did. And let's remember that there are very few swing states for the presidential election and for the Senate. And so, for instance, if you were to have very well-crafted political push in some Senate swing states, because the Republicans are defending some very tough seats in 2016, precisely because they overachieved in 2010 on the Senate map, and if a number of senators come to Senator McConnell behind closed doors and say, this is hurting me in the polls. And we don't know if this is going to happen. But if they say that, right, there will be immense pressure for the nominee to get a vote.
It's not over yet. I mean, there's right, a lot of inside political stuff going on. Marla, let me just get a quick call and he'll come right back to you.
Sure.
Okay. 410-319-8888. Excuse me. Eddie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Good. You know, I've been listening to a conversation, and I'm saying to myself, this is crazy. You know what happened? I think that the Supreme Court judges should be nonpartisan. They should not be connected with no politicians whatsoever. I mean, when they get the job to be Supreme Court judges, they should never be connected to no politicians. That's my thinking. And then I'd like to ask a question about Clarence Thomas. What is this guy doing for all these years that he's in the Supreme Court? No one could tell me what is he in there doing, because nobody has saying that he's making any decisions as far as a black man who we knew he was appointed by George Bush, the father, you know. And since then, this guy is in there doing what? I would like to know, what is Clarence Thomas doing? Could somebody tell me?
Eddie, thanks so much for your call. I think I'll let Stephen jump in, and then I'm going to hit what Marta had to say before we went to break.
I want to handle this very sensitively. Our Constitution, one of the designs is that it's a political process. It is a president who makes an appointment controlled by the Senate. When you have individuals who are at the top of the legal profession, they're very likely to be engaged and have very strong views that will consciously or subconsciously color their judgment. What I should say is that Clarence Thomas is a complicated figure because he never asks questions at oral argument, which feeds into the perception that he is not doing his job. Clarence Thomas actually writes more opinions than any other justice on the court. He is the most likely to say, I disagree with eight other people on the court. He, in fact, will disagree either on the result or the logic very frequently with Justice Scalia, and he writes it down. So in many ways, he has the most fully formed judicial viewpoint. Now, however, what I can certainly see, and I can tell coming through the emotion in your voice, is that Clarence Thomas is in many ways become an enemy of the many within the black community. And I realize that that is, for many reasons, why when we talk about nomination politics, there are many people who want to say President Obama needs to make an African-American nominee to the Supreme Court so that the African-American community has a voice. But, caller, what I will say is that Clarence Thomas was the most eloquent advocate for hate crime laws, because a majority of the Supreme Court accepted the argument that burning a cross was not itself a threat, was not itself violence. And Clarence Thomas, that is the one notable time he spoke up in court and spoke eloquently to the contrary. And I would ask you, I wish I could remember the name of the decision right now. I'd ask you to try to find that opinion and read it, because it may at least give you some comfort that to some degree there.
Where was Scalia on that? Where was Scalia on that?
Scalia, First Amendment is First Amendment. He was with the majority.
So it's like one of those rare moments where Thomas was sort of breaking from Scalia.
they break from each other quite a bit, actually.
Really? Okay.
It's just not the public perception.
How many times did he break from Scalia, though?
Let me put it this way. The three women on the Supreme Court together vote more reliably together than Scalia and Thomas. Mm. Thomas has the most idiosyncratic views, and Scalia will say, The difference between Clarence Thomas and me is that I, Justice Scalia, am a faint-hearted originalist. I will not undo decisions that have been settled law for a century. Roe versus Wade is
– just about out of time. So quick, we have to take a break here, and we got to go to our next panel coming in to join two of our guests here. So very quick thoughts. You both wanted to say something.
No, I would prefer to listen to Stephen, actually. That was really interesting.
You know, as far as, but Thomas, okay, you know, you had this one sort of anomaly of a moment where it seems like he's such this champion of civil rights by going with hate crimes. But then on everything else, I mean, on all this progress, and that's, you know, I could see that because of Thomas's upbringing and, mm-hmm. and sort of being a black man in the South. And so that's just one thing that just, you know, once again, you know, these guys, you know, sort of relying more on sort of their personal experiences, on sort of putting out their own sort of where their personal viewpoints supersede what's in the Constitution, what's in the law, like supersedes the precedents. As far as, you know, some of these groundbreaking decisions like Brown versus Board of Ed, and that's where Clarence Thomas is so like hated. Or at least so despised within the black community, because it's like, you know, here you have people dying and bleeding and fighting, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And then, you know, you have him sort of actively teaming with a jurist like Scalia and wanting to reverse things like affirmative action, so, like the Voting Rights Act and other things. And I think that there's some justification in that, yeah. Although I will say, but go ahead.
We better take a break here.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
It's the top of the hour. This has been fascinating. And first of all, Steve Klepper, a lead attorney at Crayman & Graham's Appellate Practice. It's always a pleasure to have you now. Second time in the studio. You are very thoughtful, personal around these issues, and it's really good to have your voice on these conversations. It means a lot. And we'll be back to talk about the politics of all this and the politics of the election coming up with Charles Ellison, Marta Mossberg, Lawrence Brown. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Do not leave us. Those calling in, we'll get to you.